I suck at jujitsu. How do I suck less?
I guess
this
sucks less.
Ladies and gentlemen, the
Bellator
Heavyweight Champion, the leader of
everybody, this is Josh McKinney, and I just want to welcome you to the newest episode of the I Suck at Jiu-Jitsu Show. So today, I have the Canadian Josh McKinney, Matt Kwan, on the show. If you guys don't know who Matt Kwan is, he is a jiu-jitsu competitor, a jiu-jitsu school owner, and a jiu-jitsu podcaster, who also got into jiu-jitsu because of his love for pro wrestling, which, man, if you want to talk about the Canadian version of Josh McKinney, it's that guy. But if you guys don't know of Matt, I just had his brother Steve Kwan on a couple months ago. Steve Kwan, the host of BJJ Mental Models. Matt is the host of the Essential Jiu-Jitsu podcast. It's a podcast that I've been on before, and he has really had some high-level coaches on there that are a lot more relevant than Josh McKinney. And so I think you guys would love to check out his podcast and just check out all the stuff that Matt's doing. This conversation, I anticipated it being about creativity. As we talked more and more, it really became about a few things. It became about passion and using that passion that you have to kind of free yourself from the societal norms. And then, of course, we get into conspiracy theories, which Matt's talking points on conspiracy theories were gold. I'm definitely going to offend half of you, but the other half are going to just love it. And so, and man, he went right to the bullet points on it. I can't even say anything about it. He really was ready to do that conspiracy theory discussion. It was terrific. But just this conversation in general about chasing your dreams and about finding things that you're passionate about and just living the life that you want to live. I just think that Matt can put it into words in a way that very few people have gotten to actually talk to do. And so, I won't waste too much of your time. Let's just go ahead and let this conversation speak for itself. Here is Matt Kwan from the Essential Jiu-Jitsu Podcast. Matt, how are you doing today?
What's going on, Josh? Thanks for having me.
Yeah, man, I'm excited to get another conversation in. I was on your podcast, the Essential Jiu-Jitsu Podcast, not too long ago, and I think we discovered that we had a lot in common on that episode.
For sure, and since then, you've cut your hair, you've had a child. How's life treating you?
You know, I cut my hair and had a child. You know how that goes.
Isn't it so much less annoying rolling around with like shorter hair?
Especially like my hair length in the back, I was getting people would like put their knee down and it would pin my hair onto the mat and I can't slide away. My distance management was not there.
Yeah, I know. That was the issue I kept having. And then your hair just keeps like falling out and you got to keep putting it back up in a bun. And it's just so fucking annoying. But I mean, it looks cool. I like having long hair, but I mean, even your hair right now is still kind of long ish, right?
Yeah, it's definitely longer than I kept it before I grew it out that last time, but it's short on the sides, short on the back. So it just stabs me in the eyeballs. And that's the only problem right now.
Nice. How do you feel about mullets, which seem to be so prevalent in jiu-jitsu culture nowadays?
I had a mullet for a while. I wouldn't say it was as sick as like a Joe Dirt mullet, but it was pretty sick. You know, I would do like the cut lines on the side of my head to really show that I'm from the Midwest. And, you know, it was, I loved it. Do you think, you know, was this a question that you're asking, like, I'm about to grow out my hair and do a mullet, or, you know, what's your...
No, I don't think I could ever do a mullet. I mean, it's just too much of a Chad move. But whenever I see that I'm in a division with a dude with a mullet and Crocs, I'm like, fuck, this guy's going to be a beast.
But it's something you have to back up, you know? Like, if you just have a normal guy haircut and you have sick jiu-jitsu, everybody's like, oh, I didn't see that coming.
Yeah. If you have a mullet, you have to be good. It's like in, I don't know if hockey's big where you are, but like in hockey here, if you have a tinted visor, you better be fucking sick.
You better be passed. I didn't know that. I wasn't, you know, in my city where we're at, in St. Louis, there's a lot of hockey fans. You know, the Blues won the Stanley Cup a few years ago. That was really, really exciting. That was really fun to watch, but that's kind of the extent of my, you know, of my hockey ability, and I watch, you know, Letterkenny. And so that's pretty much all I know about hockey, or Canada for that matter, you know.
There's not much more to know.
Okay, perfect.
Yeah.
So just before we really dig into the conversation, one, because I actually don't know the answer to this, and you know, more just curious for me, but two, for the listener also, what got you started in jiu-jitsu, and how long have you been training?
Geez, it's going on 16 years now. It was right after high school. My exposure to grappling in general was through pro wrestling first. I was a big fan of WWF back in the Attitude Era days. I think the first year I started watching was 1998. It was SummerSlam 98. And I remember seeing the promo. It was the Highway to Hell, Stone Cold versus Undertaker. And I was like, I don't know why, but I need to watch this. Previously I was like, oh, wrestling sucks. And then I saw the promo. I'm like, God damn it, this looks so awesome. And anyways, I was just like, I was hooked. I watched it all the way into the early 2000s. Then I gave it up. In middle school, I did a little bit of actual wrestling for a couple of years, but I was never excellent. I didn't have like great technique. I would just go in there and try and throw people, and I didn't really win a lot. And then I got into hockey. I played hockey for most of my 20s, and I remember early, I think I was 20 years old, my buddy brought home a book from the library. It was Joe Rogan and Eddie Bravo. I think they were talking about the Twister, I'm pretty sure, or it was maybe a Rubber Guard book. And I was like, huh, this is like pro wrestling, but it's real. It's almost like the moves actually work. And then, of course, UFC was getting popular. Those were kind of, you know, in the 2000s, those were like some pretty, that was when like UFC and Pride were merging. And I started watching MMA and being like, man, this is actually what I should be doing. And that was kind of my exposure to it. And then I looked up Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu classes. There was a gym down the street. Me and my buddy went to our first class, and man, I was instantly hooked. I actually, just from watching UFC, I was like, oh, a triangle, like you can strangle someone with your legs. And I remember just trying to huck something like that up on someone in my first class, and it actually worked. And I was like, whoa, I fucking submitted someone. That's so cool. Like, this is a real thing. So, and then after that, I was just instantly hooked. And another reason why I was more drawn to jiu-jitsu is because I felt like I had more of a natural connection with jiu-jitsu. I felt actually like somewhat talented, or somewhat, I had some ability that I could work off of. Whereas I used to be a fat kid, and previously in sports, I struggled through like every team sport, you know, like hockey, soccer, football. I struggled to even just like help my team, you know? Mm-hmm. And so this was the first sport where it was just me in there. No one was relying on me. So there was no team pressure. And also I didn't feel like, I felt like I could actually understand it from an early age, which was really, really rare for me. I was basically not a very athletic person growing up. So yeah, that's sort of how I got my start. And then I just never looked back. And, you know, fast forward to, it would have been about 5 or 6 years ago, I made the full switch where I quit my job and pursued jiu-jitsu full time. And yeah, I've never looked back. It's been the best decision I ever made, honestly.
So we're going to have to add growing up as a fat kid and starting jiu-jitsu because of pro wrestling to the other things that we have in common.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, it's getting a little scary at this point. because I know what it's like, you know, growing up as a kid who was just in love with pro wrestling. Before you started jiu-jitsu, did you ever hit anybody with any cool pro wrestling moves? Or after, you know?
Dude, okay. Of course. I mean, we would wrestle around in the summertime. My buddy had like a sick trampoline, and we would do entrances. We'd come out there. And then there was this little this little East Indian kid. I remember giving him the pedigree and he cried and never came back. I was just like, this is fucking sick. At one point we were going to set up tables and stuff and like throw each other through the tables. And then we're like, actually, this is a pretty dumb idea. I think we could get really hurt doing this. So, but yeah, like on the school ground, like giving each other the stunner. And of course doesn't do anything. And we're like, and then you land it and everyone's like, oh, and it's like nothing. It's not even real, right? So obviously we're giving each other stunners and pedigrees and rock bottoms from a very young age.
That's how every child probably should grow up. One time I actually had when we were in school, because there was a good group of us that all loved pro wrestling, and this pretty much put an end to the pro wrestling in school for all of us, but one of my friends hit another one of my friends with a true Undertaker tombstone pile driver.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Which you couldn't pick a more dangerous move to do, and it wasn't even in the grass. It was just in the school on the hard floor.
Dude, pile drivers are scary, man. Like, even I have kids sometimes. I'll have like a younger in the advanced class, I have like a much bigger kid rolling with a smaller kid. And there's times when they like pick them up and they're just holding them up. And I'm just like, right away, I'm like, no, put them down. Cause like, I'm just thinking like, man, something goes wrong and this kid is paralyzed. Like, I'm going to look like a complete asshole if a kid gets pile driven in my class.
Mm-hmm. That is that's always the scary thing about kids' classes is kids will always inevitably figure out new ways to harm each other. And like, you'll always see a kid like be in a triangle for the millionth time and then like start to lift the other kid up and be like, oh, wow, I could slam him down right now. I could, you know, that might work. I could hit him with the ground right now. Like, no, you can't do that, bro.
Yeah. Do you teach the kids classes at Head Nod?
I don't anymore. I did for a long time. And then they wore me down. They broke me. And eventually I passed it off.
Yeah. You know, I feel like, cause I always wonder, like, I actually really enjoy teaching the kids. At least I enjoy teaching the older kids. Okay. The younger kids, it feels actually like work, but it's still, there's still awesome parts to it. But I don't know how you feel about this. Like, you know, the cycle of an instructor, you know, you have students, you build them up, they stay with you for years and years and years. And then there'll be a couple of people who eventually want to open their own schools. You know, maybe they get promoted to black belt or even brown belt and they want to open their own schools. And it's like, I feel like if you pass off the kids program to, let's say, one of your prodigies, and then one day they want to go open a school, don't you feel like those kids have kind of formed a relationship with that instructor? And so they might be more prone to be like, well, I really like, you know, I this person's been training me since the beginning. I'm going to go and train with them if it makes sense geographically. I just feel like if I hand off my program, now it's going to be someone else potentially who's building that bond. It's almost like when a baby bird is hatched, the first thing it sees, it's like, oh, mommy, right? And that kid will have that relationship. So do you ever feel like you kind of lose touch with some of the younger students, or do you just wait for them to become like teens and then they start training with you?
So for me, I feel like we let teens come into our adult class pretty young. And that is part of it. I think also, and this isn't really even something I do. I think you can also kind of combat that with having multiple instructors, for the kids. But, that's honestly just that, not just with the kids class, but just in general. I always feel like this is an interesting topic. It's such a hard thing. I'm starting to get to this point. I have, 1, 2, 3,
I have six black belts under me now. And one of the ones I just promoted, he is, you know, it's a good distance away, but he's starting to teach at his own place. And I see that with so many of these guys that are coming up that are purple and brown belts that have dedicated their lives to jiu-jitsu at this point. It's this weird thing in jiu-jitsu where it's really, really hard to find a coach that gives you any type of blessing to leave. You know, you see so much, so many of those relationships that end up broken because of that. And it's something I've been thinking on more and more, is like, how do we even equip these guys? Because yeah, I've taught you a lot of jiu-jitsu, but I've taught you nothing about business ownership. You know, I've taught you nothing about actually what it takes to run a school and how to better run a school. And I almost, like, for me, I look at that as like this responsibility of like, you know, my coach was really cool about it with me, but I know most coaches that I've seen weren't. And, you know, mm-hmm. you had this great relationship for 10, 12 years with this guy. He was your main mentor. And then all of a sudden, when you leave to better yourself, a lot of times this, there's this stake driven in between. I have no idea on what the best way to approach that is. And, you know, what is right as the head coach that is, you know, afraid of maybe losing people out of their business. Do you have any thought on that?
I mean, you're absolutely right. Like I've gone through that too. I've seen, for myself personally, when I started my gym, it was no issue. Like I was a part of a team that, when I decided I wanted to move on and really, I was teaching like multiple days a week at this gym. And then I said, well, you know what? I'm at the point now where I feel like I should be transitioning to my own school. I knew that that was my goal. I was putting wheels in motion to make that happen. And then once I found a space, I just said to them, hey, like, I need to go do this. This is what I want to do. I want to dedicate my life to it. And they were totally understanding. But the first instructor that I had, we actually ended on bad terms, not because I was going to open a gym. I wasn't ready at that point, but I had seen he had another student who was my friend who opened a school, and he didn't get his blessing. And the way that this guy responded, it was very old school. He responded by basically he sat everyone down in class and he said, hey, so-and-so has opened his own school. I'd appreciate if you don't go train with this guy. And yeah, it was really weird. And we're all just like, what the fuck? And kind of like that whole Creonch type mentality, right? And then I've told the story on the podcast before, I'm pretty sure. It was Thanksgiving, Canadian Thanksgiving, not what we call Yanksgiving, not real Thanksgiving.
Not Yanksgiving.
Canadian Thanksgiving.
When is Thanksgiving?
When is it?
Yeah.
I don't even fucking know, dude. It's in October. I don't even know I don't know why there's two. I doesn't make any sense to me, but we have it in October usually.
Is it somebody discovering the Northwest Passage? Is it something like that?
So to be honest, I don't know. And I don't know when it even is. It's just oh, when it pops up on my calendar, they're like, oh, it's Thanksgiving. I'm like, okay, cool. Turkey and pie. Like that's all my brain thinks about. I don't even know. But it might actually be in November. I could be very, very wrong about that. But so yeah, like he sat us all down and was like, yeah, I'd appreciate if you don't go train with this guy, because he just left. He just decided to leave and he didn't want to be a part of the same lineage because I guess he had a falling out with this guy. And so anyways, I was teaching at this gym. I was a purple belt, and then I'd been teaching for like a year and honestly making pretty decent money. And the gym was close to my house, but everyone was leaving this gym. And I was actually like, hey, there's not really any serious people here. Everyone who was really, really good moved on. And it became more of a gym focused towards like recreational guys rather than competitors. So I was one of the last guys there who was really trying to like improve my jiu-jitsu and really take it to the next level. And I was kind of looking for a reason to leave, I guess you could say, because I knew that it wasn't benefiting my training to stay there. And then I went and trained with my buddy at his gym, and somehow a photo got leaked of me being there. And then I get a call from this instructor and he's like, hey, I saw that you trained there. I'm very disappointed in you. He used the words, I need to assess my moral compass and all this shit, basically like gaslighting me because he had a, he had an issue with this guy. And I was super confused. And I was just like, okay, so like, what does this mean? And he's like, well, you can't teach for me anymore. Cause it sends, he said, quote, it sends the other students the wrong message. And I'm just like, okay, dude, I'm fucking out of here. Like, yeah. I think I had like 2 months, you know, I was in a contract with him for like 2 months and I basically just fucking left. I just said, you know, thank you for giving me a reason to leave. Right. And I actually learned, it was actually beneficial because I learned how I don't want to run my business. Like a lot of things that I learned from that guy were like, okay, this really pissed me off how this ended. And the way that I was kind of locked into a contract, I was like, okay, there's tons of things here that I think nobody should have to go through. And even though the situation was negative overall, it's funny how in life you have bad situations and you can find silver linings and learning opportunities, teachable moments in those situations, how to like better treat people. And I've always carried that forward with my business. Like I don't want to ever have people feel like they can't leave if they want to leave. And I never want people to feel guilty about, you know, pursuing jujitsu for themselves. For me, I understand that as an instructor, like part of my life cycle is unfortunately to one day potentially say goodbye to students, right? Like I'm happy for anyone who wants to make a living off of jujitsu because I don't know. I'm sure you agree. It's a great life, right? It's a way to escape the system. And so when someone comes to me and they're like, hey, you know, Matt, I'm thinking about like, I want to open my own space. I'm like, I will do anything to help you do that because I know how awesome it is. And I want other people to share that life. So just let me know what I can do for you. And basically anyone who's training with me, I look at them and I'm like, one day this could be over. Like one day you might have to go run your own school and then you just got to accept it. You know, if you're in the business to get extremely wealthy or to try and hold dominion over somebody else's life or journey, I mean, you shouldn't do it. You kind of have to be able to let people go at times. And when I have people who stick with me for a long time and they tell me they don't want to open a gym, I'm like, thank you. Because that means we can still fucking train. You know, if they open their own gym, I'm not going to train with them very much. Just by the reality of our schedules conflicting. Right. And that's just, yeah. So I have seen that before and it's childish. It's immature for lack of a better word. And I think you should just be happy for your student when they want to pursue a career in jiu-jitsu.
Yeah. I completely agree with that. And I see that, I think more in the modern era, the era of jiu-jitsu that we're in, this is becoming more commonplace. I think partially it's just due to the fact that there are way more people training and that continues to be compounding. You know, so many new people are starting jiu-jitsu all the time. And so it feels like, oh, there is more potential of clients. And so from a business standpoint, I think it's a little less scary. But then you still do see a lot of people that are still in the old school of like, oh, well, you can't start a school this close to me, or you can't do that. And yeah, to me, it's just not the move. How long have you had your school for?
So I guess I technically opened my doors in 2015. So it's been like, you know, almost 9 years, but the first couple of years, it wasn't the space that I'm in right now. It wasn't established. I think for the first 3 or 4 years, we were sort of shopping around, trying to find a solid space. I moved around a couple times and the first couple gyms weren't really good fits for me overall. It was either not a space that I could have, or it was conflicting with the kids program. So I couldn't have a kids program, or it was the commute was just like 20 minutes too far for me. And I really wanted a space that was within 10-minute commute. And then finally, this place just popped up randomly. I had a guy walk in and it was a CrossFit gym previously. And he had mentioned, hey, like, you know, I know you need your own space. What do you think about sort of splitting the lease here? And then once my lease is done, I'll move out and you can expand your gym. And I was like, yeah, okay. It was cheap enough. It was close enough. And that's kind of what happened. So I think we've been in our space now for about, yeah, like 6 years, 5 years, something like that. And I've been doing full-time jiu-jitsu for probably almost 5 years now, where I quit my previous career. So Yeah, it's crazy how fast it goes by. You know, like you blink and then all of a sudden you're like, holy shit, like I have kids yellow and orange belts now. When I remember the days when it was like one kid would show up, right? Mm-hmm. I actually just did an episode on pet peeves. And one of the things I talked about was how sometimes people will drop in from out of town or even other gyms in the area. You know, maybe they want to train with their friends at your school and they come in for a night. And then I don't know if it happens to you, but I always have guys that come in and then they just think that they can train, but they don't like offer to pay a drop in or anything like that. And it's just kind of like, they almost feel like they're entitled to just come in because they know someone there. And I'm not even talking like open mats, which I still think people should contribute in some way to an open mat, but like a class, like they'll come to a class and then just like not offer to pay. And I was saying in the podcast, I was just saying like, I remember the days when I was working two jobs. I was trying to get the gym off the ground and I'd be paying rent and like no one would show up. You know, there's like when you first opened your gym and you have no member base and you're just sitting there by yourself and like maybe one person will come in, or after a couple months, you'll have a couple of people in there. And it's like, I remember those days, you know, when you were like questioning life and you were like, am I going to be able to make a living off of this? And mm-hmm. So now when I think about people who come in and they don't want to pay, it's like, they're clearly not considering those hard times when you were just like, you were wondering like, hey, is this even a good move? And you were just bleeding money. You know, anyone who starts a business is just bleeding money for the first couple of years before it either becomes a success or it fails. So, yeah, I don't know where I was going with that. I think I was just venting, but
people suck.
That,
you know?
That's one thing that bothers me is people who like don't contribute when they come in. They don't like appreciate that as a business owner, you put your neck on the line so that there could be a place to train and you could share jujitsu.
Yeah, that is, it is just some of the parts of running a jujitsu school that are one, not only there are some parts that are frustrating, but then there are just certain parts that are still unknown. You know, it's not like there is this handbook where people have been running jujitsu schools for hundreds of years and they can say, hey, these are what the best schools have done forever. And still, like when it comes to jujitsu technique, it's becoming less and less secret, but when it comes to business practice, a lot of the time it's still pretty secret, you know, and it's still pretty, pretty tight with a lot of things. And so there are all these questions, these hurdles when it comes to opening a jiu-jitsu school. When you started yours, you know, your intention was though to be full-time, correct?
Yeah. Yeah. Like I was in the culinary arts and it was just, cooking is a fun game for a young man who's in his like early 20s. And you're just like, man, like, you know, the shifts are flying by, you're ripping it up, you're just crushing, you're making shit money, but you're like meeting people and like, it's fun. And then like you hit 30 and your body just starts to get real tired, you know, and you start looking at long game and you think like, oh, what's my future in this? Am I going to be a chef when I'm stuck in an office for 12 to 14 hours a day? You know, and not getting exercise, not seeing my family, being around toxic people, being around an environment that's full of food that's trying to kill you, and just overindulging all the time. Like, is this the life that I want? And I realized, man, the jiu-jitsu, I just fell so hard for jiu-jitsu that mm-hmm. I knew I could, if I didn't do it, it was something I was going to regret. So yes, absolutely. When I was around the purple belt level that, and I was starting to teach, that's when I was discovering, okay, I think I really want to develop a way to monetize this. And previous to that, I wanted to be a cooking instructor. Like when I was going through my apprenticeship, I was like, man, like I love seeing what these culinary instructors are doing. It was super fun. The best years that I had in the culinary arts industry was my years in school. That was so fun. And looking back, I'm like, it was unnecessary. Like culinary arts nowadays, unless you're at these high-end restaurants where you make absolutely no money, it's literally just become a factory or a conveyor belt. Like anyone can do it. They're streamlining the processes so much so that like the cooking doesn't really require as much skill. You just have to work your fucking ass off. And I was realizing that it's not necessarily the people who work the hardest that move to the top, but it's people who are willing to like kiss the manager's ass and like play the game, you know, talk the talk. And I was just never one of those, like anyone who knows my personality on social media or in the gym, like I wear my heart on my sleeve, you know, and I get myself into trouble sometimes and I say whatever I mean what I say. And so it didn't jive well with the management team at the hotel that I was at. And I was just like, man, there's no future in this. Why am I doing this? So pretty early, basically after, right as I was finishing my apprenticeship, I was already thinking, how am I going to leave this industry? How am I going to start to jump ship and do jiu-jitsu full time? And that was like a process that took a couple of years, honestly.
Do you still cook for enjoyment? Do you still cook for, I mean, obviously for eating, but for kind of hobby and a way to express creativity?
No, because I never was, you know, you'll see like food on Instagram and these chefs are like, they're like placing tweezers with like little flowers on plates. And they're, you know, the food that looks like, you know, one bite, like fine dining, like it's beautiful. It's art, it's expression. I get that. But I've always looked at that food and just been like, who the fuck would want to pay double or triple what they should be paying per plate? And then they leave hungry. Mm-hmm. And they're like, oh, that was such a great experience. It's like, when I go out to eat, I want to be full. Mm-hmm. Honestly, the food that I love to eat and I love to make is rustic, good, well-seasoned food, you know, that my mom would make, like something that I eat and it's memorable, but it's not necessarily pretentious or fancy. Like all the fine dining stuff, if I'm going to go to those restaurants, I need to have something to eat after, because I was a fat kid, dude. I need to leave full. Like I can't
In your heart, you're still a fat kid.
I am. Like I can't be paying hundreds of dollars and leaving hungry. So, mm-hmm. you know, I had friends in the culinary industry. I've gone out to eat with them a couple times and they're like, yeah, I spend my whole paycheck just going to the different restaurants in town. And I'm like, are you fucking stupid? Like, how do you live? All of your money is going to restaurants. Like, oh, I tried the new chef's restaurant at this, you know, this dining room, whatever. And I'm like, what? Like, okay, cool. Like, I'm going to go strangle someone. It's way cooler. Like, I'd rather eat like a really well done, well-seasoned stew than, mm-hmm. you know, a Michelin star plate that's like this big. So that's always been the food that I like to cook and I like to eat. I've never been like, I've never really bought into the current trends. In fact, there are certain trends in cooking that I look at and I'm just like, man, this is like so off-putting for me because I like real food. And have you heard of like sous vide, for example? You know what uh-huh. this is? So yeah. Everyone's into sous vide, right? And I'm not saying you can't, they can't produce a good product, but like these people are taking like beautiful steaks and like simmering it in a plastic bag and then just like marking it on the grill. And they're like, oh, look at this. And I'm just like, so ass backwards. You should take the steak and throw it on the grill and let it char up from raw. You know what I mean? And it's mm-hmm. just, I've compared the two products and I'm like, it's not an improvement. All it means is that you can't fuck it up. Like it's held at medium rare, but you can't fuck it up, but you lose juices and it's got this weird texture to it because it's been just like slowly simmered. So little trends like that on my way out of the industry, I saw that and I was just like, man, I got to get out of here. Like jiu-jitsu was calling me and the quicker I got out, the better. And I've never looked back. It's been such a good decision. I think for anyone listening, you know, maybe you're not, I mean, I'm sure you're into jiu-jitsu if you're listening, but maybe you're not into the idea of opening your own academy. I always just recommend to the kids that I teach and to my own kids, I'm like, you guys do what you love to do. And if you can own your own business, I'm telling you, if you have that mindset, like I want to lead, I want to have my own business, that's the best way to kind of, like I said, game the system, right? That's the best way to like have the freedom to run the business however you want, you know, manage people how you want, say whatever you want, have the same schedule that you want. You know, if I stayed in culinary arts, I'd be missing all my kids' birthdays, Thanksgivings, Yanksgivings, fucking Christmas, like New Year's. Like, you miss it all, right? You're always there. So it's been freeing having my own gig.
So two places I want to go with that. First, not a fan of sous vide steaks. Totally on the same page. I have a sous vide machine, and really, I think I just bought into the marketing of it. I think it was marketed really well. All of the YouTuber cooks that I watched had sous vide machines. And so I'm like, oh yeah. And it took a couple months. And then one day, I made a ribeye for my wife and I, like a 2-inch thick, really good ribeye, in my cast iron. Have I always made it with brown butter? And we both took a bite of it. And I was like, hey, babe, this is better, isn't it? And she's like, yeah. I go, you know, this took 7 minutes instead of 4 hours. And you know, I wasn't using plastic bags that their seal breaks or anything like that. And
it's ridiculous, dude. Honestly, like cryovacking is a very good tool for marinating, for preserving. And I'm not saying that you can't sous vide something and like you could sous vide something and serve it to someone and they'd be like, this is fucking amazing. You know, because most people don't really like notice the differences, right? Like I have a pretty acute palate when it comes to seasoning. If I look at food, I can generally mimic it. It's actually a skill that I feel has carried well into jujitsu for me. Mm-hmm. So I can like tell the differences between something that's been sous vide and something that's been cooked from raw. Mm-hmm. You know, the juices, the way that the meat, like for sous vide, if you sous vide a steak, it's weird. You cut it open and the steak, it almost kind of looks like deli meat. It's like the steak is cooked pink the entire mm-hmm. way. But what I like is when you throw a fucking raw steak on a grill and then it's like different degrees of doneness until it gets to the center that's pink. And then it's different degrees of doneness. It's more well done near the end. And it's got that crispy sort of crust on the outside. And it's just whether you grill it or whether you cook it in a cast iron. So it's like, I don't know. For me, I've ran the comparison multiple times with different proteins. Like I said, I'm not saying you can't serve something sous vide and be like, oh, this is great. But I don't think it's better.
Yeah.
It's like never better. So uh-huh. why would I, you know, when you're in a, you know, this is what it looks like in a commercial kitchen. You're in a lunch rush or a dinner rush and you're like, okay, I got a lamb loin and whatever. It's like, okay, I'm going to take my lamb loin out of the water that's been sitting in there for four hours, just holding temp. Then you open the bag. It's all like shriveled up and sort of shriveled up to this shape that it was sous vide in. And then you just mark it and then you serve it. And it's like, oh, this is great. You can't fuck up the lamb loin because it's already cooked. It's like, this is hack. This is literally, this is not the reason why I got into culinary arts. You know, if this was happening more commonly when I first started, I would have never gotten into it. I was like, I want to make good food that my mom fucking makes. You know, and I want to serve food. You asked me earlier, like, do I still cook to express myself? I like to cook to provide. So for my kids, I'll cook. For myself, I'll cook. It's always like hearty, rustic food. It's never fancy. And I love cooking for friends and family. Like if I have people over and you cook a meal for them, that is still something that does, it gives me like really good enjoyment because you're not, when you serve someone food, you're actually, whether they know it or not, you're serving them like a memory. You know what I mean? Like for me, certain foods and certain songs bring back memories. They bring back experiences and like you're sharing that with that person. I don't know, not to get sentimental or anything, but it's like there's a value to food aside from nourishment. You're when you share food with someone you love, someone you care about, and you really put your heart and soul into a dish and they remember it years from then, it's kind of a special thing, right? So I still do like cooking for loved ones and friends.
That's I totally understand that. You think back to, you know, like you were saying, things your mom used to make. You think back to when you walk into your mom's house and you're like, Mom, remember when you made this? You know, and like you have this weird, you know, memory associated with a piece of meat, you know, that was just cooked in the right way. That's something really, really cool. So I just wanted to, you know, there are so many different things, though. That's kind of why I ask about your creativity when it comes to cooking. There's so many things that you do that I look at as creative or just,
What's up, guys? Josh McKinney here. Just wanted to interrupt this episode and tell you about something really exciting that we have going on at SimplifyingJujitsu.com right now as we speak. And that is this. If you want to level up your guard passing, if you want to have an understanding of guard passing that nobody in your gym, nobody that you compete against has, you need to understand distance from guard passing. More specifically, you need to understand chest over chest and excessive distance and the importance of these two distances and how these two distances make you unsweepable, unsubmittable while you are on top. And the more you can understand them, the more you can attain these two distances, the more you can bounce back and forth between these two distances, and the more you are immune to jujitsu while you are on top. And the only way to get this understanding right now is with the seminars that I did at Watson Martial Arts and Parada Jiu-Jitsu over the last couple months. These two seminars combined for the price of one will change the way you look at guard passing. They will change the way you look at top in general. And they are only available at SimplifyingJiu-Jitsu.com. And if you purchase these two seminars for the price of one, you also get a third bonus seminar, what we call The Pinch. This is about a 35-minute seminar where we look at what upper body control actually is, what to actually do once you finally attain chest over chest, and how to keep it forever with very minimal effort and being able to put a lot of pressure on your opponents. And that is, again, only available at SimplifyingJiu-Jitsu.com. We'll make sure to link it in the description. Let's go ahead and get back to the episode.
Just passion. So for instance, you are a jiu-jitsu school owner, you have a podcast, you still compete at a high level in jiu-jitsu. You just did East Coast Trials. We didn't know each other at the time, so we didn't run into each other, but we were both at Jiu-Jitsu Con competing. And you know, there's this question that I'm often asked when I do other people's podcasts or even when people are on mine or in person, and I never seem to have a good answer. But luckily, you and I have so much in common, so I get to ask you the same question. When it comes to, you know, those three things, competitor, podcaster, jiu-jitsu coach, why? Why do you do all those things? Because I'm sure that at this time for you, you're at a point where you could probably just be a jiu-jitsu school owner. You don't have to compete anymore. And, you know, for you and I, competing costs us money. It does not. Nobody sees that you.
So does podcasting.
Exactly. And nobody sees that you have a jiu-jitsu podcast and they go, oh, I'm going to train at that gym. And nobody sees that you compete and they go, oh, I'm going to train at that gym. So these things, maybe in the long run, we hope that they will account for some type of financial gain. But at least for right now, we do them without that. And there is still so much enjoyment out of that. Why do you think that is?
Like, why do I do it still?
Yeah, why do you do it?
Dude, that's such a good question. And honestly, I've thought about that. I've been like, man, you know, if I just did coaching, I would have so much free time. Like, it would be fucking so easy. If I didn't have to do the podcast, if I didn't do the online academy, if I didn't compete, it'd be so much easier. Why do I do those things? Right. That's a good question. Couple reasons. It's good marketing. Like people see me popping up constantly on their Instagram reel, whether they like it or they hate it, they see me. And then they're like, fuck, like this guy is talking. And whether or not I actually know what I'm talking about, they perceive that I do. Mm-hmm. And they know that I have a gym. So it kind of does feed leads into the gym. And just like competing, I think competing is one of the best forms of marketing, honestly. Even if you lose, if you go to these competitions and you make a serious run or you're just seen out there, it's great for marketing. It's on another level, it's great for your students, especially like kids. Like it's great for my kids to see that their coach still competes is still willing to win or lose or put it on the line or whatever. And when we go into a competition, I always ask them, I'm like, how are you feeling? Are you nervous? They're like, yeah, I'm really nervous. I'm like, I'm fucking nervous too. Let's go out there and be nervous. I don't say fucking around though. I'm nervous too. Let's go out there and be nervous together and have some fun and see what happens. Right. And like, and it's cool to, I guess like lead by example in that way. But I've never been someone who, you know, even though you said, yes, it's nice to do things eventually for monetary gain, or that would be, I guess, like a good measurement of success. I've never done things just because I wanted money. If I did that, I would have never gotten to cooking. I would have never gotten into jiu-jitsu. You know, I would have gotten into like stock trading or some office job that, you know, that I'm not passionate about. So I've always been passion-based. That's why I got into cooking. I like doing things with my hands. I like testing my knowledge, and I really like teaching people. Like I said, I was going to be a cooking instructor, and then jiu-jitsu kind of just like overcame me. And then I realized I wanted to be a jiu-jitsu instructor, but either way, I wanted to be in that teaching role where I'm sort of sharing and helping people. That's so another reason why I might do those things, honestly, if I'm being totally transparent, is just ego. I don't know. I feel like I want to contribute, and I want to show what I can do and what I know. And that's the ego in me, whether it's good or bad ego, I don't know, but I guess those things keep motivating me. Like if I go to East Coast Trials or West Coast Trials, like I'm 30, I'll be 30. Fuck, how old am I again? I'm 36, right? My birthday's in February. Like I'm going to be, I'm too old to be hanging with these guys. Really? If we're being totally honest, that's why they have masters divisions. It'd be weird if I won East Coast Trials. It'd be weird if I won West Coast Trials at this point in my life, you know? And why do it then? Why spend thousands of dollars to go to Atlantic City and do a tournament that costs money rather than there's a chance of making money? It's like, it's my ego telling me like, yeah, just go do it. Like, go have fun while you still can. You only got a couple years left where you could even make this respectable even. So why waste those years, right? I think the last thing I'll say is the worst feeling for me is a feeling of regret. So I don't want to be, 10, 20 years from now where all my hair is gray and being like, I should have done more. Like I should have, why did I hold back? You know, why didn't I keep competing with those guys? Why didn't I try to do the trials when I was still in my 30s? You know, why didn't I do that podcast? Why? Oh, I should have done that. That's like the worst thing for me. And ultimately that was the mindset that helped me switch careers, is because I envisioned myself as a chef, you know, stuck in an office for however many hours a day and looking out the window and being like, well, there wouldn't be a window, but being like, man, I should have done something more. I should have gone for it. Why didn't I do that? It's too late now. Why didn't I? And I just thought of that feeling and I'm like, no, I refuse to have that regret. Right. So I think trying and failing is so much more important than just not trying.
Man, that's a great answer. I think that, I get the feelings that you're talking about. I get the ego part of it too. The desire, my dad has always been a small business owner. And so that's something that was always instilled in me, was like, being able to have control of your life is so important.
The best currency, man. Health. I think health is the best currency, because without health, everything falls to shit. But to have freedom and to be like, I'm going to get someone to cover tonight because I want to take my lady out for a show, or we're going to close like Christmas is coming up, right? I don't know about you, but like, we're going to still have open mats, but I'm not going to run classes for like a good 2 weeks. And I'm just going to be like, yep, I'm just going to close the gym. Like I can just do that, you know? Mm-hmm. And everyone's like, yeah, that's cool. It's like, wow, I can just take 2 weeks off during Christmas. Never in a million years in cooking could you have that freedom. You know, it doesn't matter if you're the highest level chef, you can't have that. And it's just that freedom, man. That's why I always tell these kids, like, find something you're awesome at and something you love to do, and then try and find a way to sell that. Try and find a way to make people want that service or that product. And like, you'll never work another day in your life.
So on that note, do you think, because obviously I totally agree. I am totally on the same page of of, you know, finding that freedom. You know, we just took another big risk after having a child that my wife quit her job to be full time at the gym and to be the full time general manager. It's just something that has just always been in, you know, our mindset towards life is to have that freedom. But do you think that any part of that is personality, is how, you know, just like things that we value? Or do you think that is, and obviously, you know, I'm asking you to think about other people's, you know, ideas and other people's motivations, but do you think that there are people who are happier working for someone else? And
100%.
You do?
Oh yeah. There are tons of people who don't want to be in this like entrepreneurial leadership role, and that's cool. So it's not for everyone. That's true. You know, like I just like to plant the seed in the kids' heads, especially like I try to say, hey, don't you think like I got a pretty cool job? They're like, yeah, this is cool. Like you just teach kids jujitsu. I'm like, yeah, wouldn't you like something like that? And they're like, yeah, I think that would be kind of cool. So I just like plant the seed. I actually have a bunch of young kids that are talking about like, one day I want to be an instructor. I want to have an academy. Right. So, and then they help with the younger kids and they're basically like free labor. And it's really cool to see them start to develop their coaching skills and having that entrepreneurial mindset from such a young age. But absolutely, there are totally, I'd say the majority of people would rather go and work for someone, right? They would rather go and just sort of like punch the clock. I'm just like, I'm playing my position in the company or whatever. And I'd say it's actually pretty rare to find like really driven business minded entrepreneurs.
Yeah. And I almost think I think back to this conversation, that I had a few years ago with one of my cousins. He had worked a 9-to-5 and it was a pretty cool job for a very long time. And he had wanted to get out. And then when he finally did, and he had, He started to get to kind of be in charge. He kind of started to have people underneath him at the business that he started. And we had this conversation and I remember him going, you know, one thing is when I would leave my old place of work, I would just leave it. And he's like, the difference is now the business follows me home. And he's like, and it's never, you know, I'm sure that happens for you as a jiu-jitsu owner. You have, you know, different relationships that get broken that are intertwined with your business, and you have, you know, different things that happen. So yeah, I do think that there are people that would rather not have that responsibility. But I'm on the other side of, as you say, the way to beat the system. And, you know, I think that is huge. But on that note of beating the system, I was specifically told, when I, interviewed your brother before, interviewed your brother, Steve, before, interviewing you, he said, you know, man, you know, you'll really love having Matt on the podcast. He goes, just don't ask him about conspiracy theories. And so... Obviously,
what is it with leftists and hating conspiracy theories? I don't understand that.
It's like
from I find them fun, and I find like COVID, for example. I remember people were like, when I was like, you know, this is kind of weird. Like, I don't know what your stance is on COVID, but I was just like, it's weird that the government is mandating me to put something in my body to go to a restaurant, and it's weird that the government is telling me to test people's or to ask people about their medical history before I let them into my school. Like, you can say whether you want about got to stay safe and all this stuff, but like, that's weird to me. Like that, it felt weird. And instantly the response I get from all these people, and all of them like generally on one side of the political spectrum, was you're a conspiracy theorist. Your thought process is dangerous. Like, don't ask questions, just trust the science. And I'm like, why can't you ask questions? Like, so I'm not allowed to be like, to question something and be like, well, this just feels wrong to me. Like, what if we were like, oh, you know what? Like, people who don't want to get vaccinated, like, they're the most dangerous people. Let's all put them on cattle cars and ship them away so that they're not a danger. Is anyone going to be like, oh, that's weird. Like, or is everyone going to be like, don't say anything, 'cause then you're a conspiracy theorist. You know what I mean? So it's like, that's that diversity of thought and opinion. That's the real diversity that I think should be promoted, is people all being able to talk about something and discuss, you know. So the whole thing about how conspiracy theories are bad, a lot of them are ridiculous. Don't get me wrong. I'm not like, I don't think the earth is flat or anything like that. But I do, like, if someone's like, yeah, the earth is flat, there's an ice wall, and this is my evidence, I'll be like, okay, like, I'll entertain this. This sounds interesting. I'm not just going to be like, yeah, you're a fucking idiot asshole, and, you know, I've labeled you as something forever. It's like, oh, okay, you've got a different opinion from me. That's interesting. You know, like, that's sort of where my state of mind is.
And so, I think that most people that listen to the podcast know that I illegally ran my gym weeks after the first shutdown started, kept it open for a very long time through everything.
Did you do that like under the radar, or were you like promoting, yeah, we're open?
I did everything under the radar. I was like, so I've, you know, we have a mission statement at our gym, and it is that our current customers are number one priority. And I have always like put that into place of like, okay, well, maybe we don't add anybody. And at first, I would say the first 2 weeks, maybe we had some different, we had better protocols where we were like having smaller groups training. And then we did even still have, we had like a few like quarantine groups of maybe like six people that would come in on their own time and do their own thing. But mainly we were competing in 2020, you know, we were. And so I don't know how we would have been leaving Illinois to go to Texas to compete if we weren't all training, you know. But on that, give me, you know, as I would agree that most conspiracy theories that I don't even say that I believe in them or not, but most of them are fun. You know, it's interesting.
They're very fun.
And it's just this weird mindset that people have that, like, today in 2023, we are inherently smart. We are completely all knowing. We are enlightened, and we know everything that there is to know. So be sure to not question anything. But when you look 13 years ago in 2010, and you compare what we knew then versus what we know now, and you go, oh, it's different. We've learned that we were wrong in a lot of different places. And so I'm always, I always question, like, well, why can't we still be wrong? But on that note, give me one of your fun conspiracy theories. Give me something that you like. What's one of your go-to, your favorite? Maybe you're going to a tournament and you guys have driven there, competed, and now you're driving back hours and you're in deep conversation with these guys and you start to share some good, you know, you're looking up at the stars and you're like, you know, I think that's a UFO, bro. Like, give me something. What's one of your go-tos?
I mean, I think one of the biggest ones is the moon landing. I don't think that we did go. Whether or not we've sent like non-manned spacecrafts there, I don't know, but pretty sure man hasn't gone there. And it's not like, I don't even base it on the footage. Like, the footage to me is suspect, but I'm not like, oh, look at the flag or whatever, blah, blah, blah. Even though I think that those are good points. It's like, there's things about NASA and how they talk about, the water level, the water level rising. Florida's supposed to be underwater right now. It's not. The water level really hasn't risen at all. Even though they said that the polar ice caps are going to melt, you know, that movie Waterworld, and how that's going to be our future. It's like, that didn't happen. I think the Van Allen belt, like the radiational field that surrounds lower Earth orbit, I'm not so sure that we can even get out of that. And I feel like it's just weird that it was a live streamed event in 1969 from the moon that people could see in their living room. I'm like, how, What's the technology behind that? How could they live stream it? And how could they send those guys there on the same weekend as Woodstock, if I'm not mistaken, and then come back, you know, no issues. And then if you ever watch Buzz Aldrin in his interviews, he talks about how, like, yeah, the truth is hidden and all this stuff. And, like, you know, he looks like a frail old man who's been living a lie forever. Even one of the last voyages they did, I think it was in 1972, they have the footage of the lander taking off from the moon, and something is panning up. The camera is panning up and zooming in as it's taking off. I'm like, who did they leave behind? Like, how is that being done in 1972? You're going to tell me that someone is controlling a camera robotically as they're leaving? Like, that's the narrative, right? That's what they want you to believe. And so there's so many things I look at and I'm like, but with my own two eyes, this seems not real. And you can say whatever you want. You can call me a conspiracy theorist, but, like, to some degree, I have to trust my own eyes. And then there's NASA saying that they no longer have the telemetry data to the trip to the moon. So it's like, what do you mean? That's like the most important voyage in history. They just don't have the data anymore. Like, you just, what did you record Matlock on the same fucking VHSs or something like that? Like, what do you mean you don't have that? So that, to me, when I see things like that, I'm just like, oh, okay. Like, I just don't trust basically anything I hear on mainstream news. Now, if I hear anything on mainstream news, the first thing I do is I say, okay, I'm not saying it's true. I'm not saying it's false. I just don't know. And I'm happy not knowing, and I'm happy not even staying neutral on it. But one thing is for sure, I feel like it's unlikely that we put men on the moon, in my opinion. And the thing is, people are like, so I always hear two things from people who are like really into this, like, space porn stuff. The first thing is they say, why would they do that, right? If you think about it, if you believe that, and you look at the footage and you know it looks like shit, and you look at the rover or the lunar lander, and you know that it looks like shit, you know that it doesn't look like a legit craft of any kind, and you know that they didn't have that technology to do a live stream without lag, you know, in 1969, if you believe that, like, you will literally believe anything that you're told. So, like, it's almost like it programs you to accept any narrative in a way. The other thing I hear people say is, oh, well, I think we went, but I could see that the footage that was released, I've heard this from multiple people. They're like, oh yeah, that footage, I could see them recording that and that footage being fake because they were, like, missing footage on the trip, but that doesn't mean they didn't go. And I'm like, so you're willing to admit that the footage looks fake. You think the footage could be fake, but you also are standing by that they went. To me, I'm just like, okay, man. Like, that's when I see that people are capable of being programmed, and they're not capable. A lot of people are not capable of thinking of, like, another opinion, right? Mm-hmm. So if someone was like, oh, I think we went to the moon, but let me hear your argument, that's cool. But if they're like, no, you're a fucking idiot because you're questioning this, that's when I'm like, oh, okay. Like, you're dogmatic about it. Like, it's creating an emotional response, rather than you just being like, oh yeah, like, let's hear what you have to say, even though I disagree.
Man, I think that
I'm a conspiracy theorist. Let's just be honest.
I get it. I think I probably am too, depending on, you know, what conspiracy it is. But I think that, you know, not even with conspiracies, I think that same ideology it's probably present in everything, but jiu-jitsu is something that I have some authority to speak on, and it's present in jiu-jitsu, that there is, you know, no, this is the way that jiu-jitsu has to be trained, and this is the only way to do it, and if you aren't doing it this way, you're a complete idiot. And you see that so much, but on the same perspective, it's like, well, this wasn't the way we were doing it 5 years ago. And you were saying that same stuff 5 years ago about something completely different. Why should we be sure that you're doing it perfectly now? You know?
Mm-hmm. Here's a conspiracy that's in jiu-jitsu. I actually just interviewed Robert Deagle last night, and we were talking about heel hooks in the gi, right? And so the conspiracy theory is, if you let heel hooks happen in the gi, then there's too much friction to escape, and the heel hook will be somehow more dangerous because you're wearing gis and there's more friction. Am I wrong in saying that? Like, that's why they don't allow reaping and leg and heel hooks, right? Like, that's what we've been told to believe, right? Okay. So we were kicking around the idea of an ADCC division in the gi, like ADCC gi championships, same rule set completely. So all subs legal, you know, overtime rounds, whatever. And now let's look at 50-50 as a position when heel hooks are allowed in the gi. Okay. So the conspiracy theory is that if you get heel hooked in the gi, you won't be able to escape because the friction is too strong. It's just too dangerous, right? But what I actually see happening, if they allowed heel hooks in the gi, is the guy tries to heel hook you, and then it's actually harder to do the move because the person can literally just grab you and pull you in, right? And prevent you from creating extension, prevent you from going belly down, et cetera, et cetera. So I actually think not only would heel hooks be more difficult in the gi because of these reasons, but I also think that allowing heel hooks in the gi wouldn't solve the issue of 50-50 being a boring position, because how are you going to heel hook someone from 50-50 when they can literally just grab your collar and hold you there? So imagine, we were laughing about it. Imagine they allow heel hooks in the gi, and then they're like, okay, 50-50 is now an open position. You can't just, it's not just a battle to stand up and sweep anymore. Now it's a battle to actually, okay, we can, this is not going to be a stalling position. We can sub each other. And then they allow heel hooks in the gi in competition. And now all it turns into is someone's trying to heel hook someone and the other guy's just holding on. And it's just another level of stalling. It's just another stalemated position, even though the submission is allowed.
You know, and that also on the same conspiracy angle, so I've actually competed in gi divisions that have allowed heel hooks. One time, really specific situation. One time I got put in, and this sucked too. The match was like in the finals for like $2,500 too. And I get put in 50-50 and I figure four my legs, and I actually figure four in between his body and his lapel. So basically my legs, the lock is being blocked by his lapel, and he was able to pull on his lapel and expose my heel and heel hook me through his lapel and finish me. So
but if your foot is in the jacket, that's technically, that shouldn't happen, right? Like the ref should take the jacket and move it, right?
Yeah, I agree. I have $2,500 that I don't have that agrees with you too. But the thing I always think about too is how much gi jujitsu could be eliminated by adding maybe not even the heel hook as much as the reap. How many, like, you think about all these guards that extend you out, you get to play this like third layer of jujitsu because of the gi, and how many of those things would be ruined if you allowed, right? And so to me, it's like this level of, you know, hey, we can't change because this is what it is. And so I would definitely, if they had some ADCC divisions that were in the gi, I would absolutely watch those. I think that would be
100%,
out of interest. Like, hey, how is this going to turn out? You know, you let some of the young guys go, you know, 25 and under, and you go, hey, maybe we are wrong, and maybe the friction will just cause everyone's ACLs to tear. Let them do it. Let them take the hit.
Yeah, put the young kids in there, and having also understand. Again, I was talking with Robert about this. Like, we were contrasting IBJJF gi with ADCC, or even IBJJF no gi with ADCC, right? It's a completely different sport. Mm-hmm. It's IBJJF is more, I don't know if I'd say beneficial, but it's more forgiving towards conservative players where you can get an advantage and chill, right? ADCC, you can't do that. ADCC incentivizes initiation. So you have to come forward in ADCC. So it would force you as the gi player to make submissions happen. And even though there's no advantages, right? You can't just get an advantage and now you're playing against the clock, right? That's how IBJJF has played a lot of the time, whether we like to admit it or not, right? We're not all We're not all Gordon Ryan. We're not all Nicholas Mirigali, where we could just get submissions in the gi. It's actually like really hard to do, I find. But in ADCC, it's like you can't just sit back. You have to come forward. Otherwise, you're going to lose. And the turtle rule, you know, if you think about the turtle rule in ADCC, every time your back is exposed in the gi, I think the consequences of that are so much worse than in a no-gi situation. Like if you give someone a turtle in the gi and they grab the collar behind your head, like it's like hard to get out, you know? So I feel like it would actually kind of reinvigorate the gi for ADCC to do something like that. Plus we would see gi grapplers who have no interest competing in ADCC finally come over and compete under that rule set. And yeah, I think the idea of reaping in the gi, like if you think about all the different spider guards you can play, like spider X guard positions, you could just totally take a sleeve grip and kick their leg over there. And then while you're on the inside, just reap the shit out of them and go into sweeps and attack. So I think it's a type of jiu-jitsu that is almost completely left untapped, you know, like there's systems there that we haven't even discovered yet because there's not a lot of tournaments that allow it. But I agree. Why hasn't it switched? It's because we've always done something this way.
And that is like, there is something about the belly down rule in ADCC that I think is so much more valuable to grappling than, you know, this is one of really the only complaints that I have when I watch IBJJF and when I compete in IBJJF, the fact that I can't belly down and sweep from turtle and get anything for it is the most ridiculous thing. I'm still going to, if you get me to belly down from my guard and then I sweep you from there, you're up an advantage on me. I went from bottom to top and stopped you from passing my guard. And
wait, say that again.
So if you are on top trying to pass me and you get me to belly down, that's automatically going to be, if I use bellying down to retain, I'm automatically going to give up an advantage. You're going to gain an advantage for that.
Right.
And if I do, like, we call it like the fat man roll, where you trap the arm and you roll the person.
Makikomi roll. Yeah.
Yes. And so you go to there.
Trap and roll. Yeah.
Exactly. You go to there, you get nothing for that as the bottom player. And yes. So from there, I'm now on top. I went from bottom to top and you are winning by an advantage. That is, to me, that makes no sense. The fact that I
same thing in ADCC too. There's no score for that because you're not chest to chest.
But you don't lose points for bellying down, right?
Right.
You don't, unless they get their hooks, right? Unless they put you in a position that is actually in danger. And so that's just like looking at the belly down. I don't like that. Like that is looked at as this position that doesn't work, because if you can protect your neck, the position works very well, you know? It's almost like, to me, it almost stifles that such a simple thing, but giving that advantage almost stifles people's ability to do jiu-jitsu, because when you get to roll with people that have really good turtle and really good wrestle up from turtle, a really good leg locks from turtle, you go, oh my gosh, this is a type of jiu-jitsu that I never even got to experience before because my rule set never allowed for it. And that's something that's always a complaint. But then on the other hand, I love that you have to push the pace of the match in ADCC as the top player. But there are times as the top player that I do think that backing out is the best option for you when you're starting to get in a bad spot. And that's the value of top. You know, you don't get to do that as the bottom player. You know, it's just too hard to back out of those positions. And so there is that level of like stifle. So this is my solution to everything. I had this idea last night on the perfect jiu-jitsu rule set. So submission only, EBI rule, except when you go to the EBI overtime, it's not back or armbar. You start in 50-50 guard and you both have an inside heel hook and the rest says go. And then whoever wins, yo, think about it. The overtimes will be 3 seconds. You'll never have to worry about the overtimes.
It's just a game of chicken.
It's just a game of chicken.
Locked hands, unlocked legs, just first person to go.
I was that's thinking you're awesome. The first person I've laid this idea on. What do you think? Are you willing to invest in the Josh McKinney Invitational Tournament series?
You're joking, right? This is a joke. Yeah, right? I'm joking. Okay, good. I'm like, dude, like, well, first of all, I think overtimes, like EBI overtimes, are the stupidest thing ever.
Totally agree.
So stupid. I anyone who has half a brain knows why I think that. Like, I think the reason why somebody might like that rule set is because they lack in positional play and they're really, really good at those positions, right? Mm-hmm. But the thing is you have to get to those positions. Like, honestly, I think who's number one is probably one of the best rule sets as far as sub only is concerned. I think who's number one is the best rule set. And in terms of points, they're not perfect, but I think ADCC is probably the best rule set. I have my criticisms of that as well. I go back and forth with advantages. They're awesome when they work in your favor, but they suck when you lose by an advantage, right? Uh-huh. So like, I don't like how easy it is to just get advantages. I prefer a rule set that is more forgiving when there's a bunch of movement going on and like you almost take their back and then they escape and they almost pass your guard and you escape. And like, there's tons of movement and there's not necessarily like a score from that. For me, I think it's a lot more exciting because just naturally as athletes, we will tend to game the system whenever we can. So if we get up by two advantages, we look at the scoreboard, there's 2 minutes left. Like, you're damn right, you're going to be playing that clock. We all just want to win matches, right? Mm-hmm. I think like my one criticism for, I have a couple, but one of them that I don't like about IBJJF is how you have to sweep from a guard, right? Like, mm-hmm. if you're in bottom side control and you bridge and roll someone and you end up in top side control, and that's like, how is that not a sweep? How should that not be rewarded? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And there, I remember being at a ref seminar and I asked the guy that, and he said, oh, well, we prioritize the act of re-guarding or whatever. And I'm like, yeah, but it's still a move. Like, you know, someone's in north south and you sort of tip them one way and then go the other way and you reverse them. Now you're on top north south. Like, you just ended up in an awesome position. You did it with intention and with control. To me, makes no sense why that's not scored. I'm not a big fan of that rule. But also, I got a question for you. So we're talking about turtle, right? Do you think turtle is more of a guard or more of a pin? Because I've talked to Greg Souders about this, and I believe he considers that kind of a pinning position, right? Like being on top of someone, even though you're not pinning them, you're in, I guess you could say, a dominant position. But then there's a lot of good turtle players who literally refer to turtle as a guard. And I agree with you. If you do a Makikomi and sweep someone from turtle, that should be rewarded as if turtle is a guard. So when you look at the turtle position, do you look at it more of as a pin or a guard or even something else?
So I look at it as a guard, but something I will teach my students is when we look at pinning, my idea on pinning is shoulders and hips generally being flat on the mat, right? The reason that that is important, the reason that that's relevant to me is because you can put your weight on somebody and put it on their torso when their shoulders and hips are on the mat, right? And so you're able to crush, you're able to wear someone out. The problem with how most people do turtle is they will keep their hips and shoulders equal distance from the mat. And this allows me as the top player to center my weight and put my weight on you. My first time rolling with Chris Paynes, I've rolled with him a few times since. It really was the reason that I started to understand the position as a guard, something he never allowed. One, he never allowed me to control his hips. He never allowed me to win inside space. But something that was really noticeable for me is when my weight would go to his shoulders would raise off the mat. When my weight would go to his shoulders, his hips would raise off the mat. So there was never a point that I actually felt as though I was able to put any real weight on him for any significance. And so that's kind of why I don't look at it as a pin until you flatten, right? When you flatten or when somebody just sucks at the position and they sit there for you, I do look at it like you are pinning the person. But I just think it can be played in a way that if you never keep both shoulders and both hips equal distance from the ground and you're never square to the ground, I think that it can be played in that way that it is not a pin. It's
so
my opinion on it.
So in the IBJJF definition of a guard, It's anytime your legs manage distance or are barriers between you and your opponent, right? Mm-hmm. From the bottom position. So then if, let's say, Turtle becomes a guard, let's say IBJJF is like, you know what? We've changed our mind. Turtle is now a position that you can score from. We consider it a guard. What do you then define a guard as? Because the legs are not being used to manage distance anymore, and your back is exposed. So if that becomes a rule, how do you then define the guard in IBJJF?
I guess I define more of the points, what the goal is for that position, because really the goal is for that position is going to be to flatten the person completely or to get your hooks in. And so I would look at either of those two things as maybe points of value or place to put points. I don't think I would say, I wouldn't define it as, oh, you're passing the guard. I mean, I guess you could say that maybe it's not even a guard then in that situation, but I don't think it is. It is a position that has both offense and defense, right? It is a position that we can, from a lot of different ways, attack from. You know, we can use it to create different leg entanglements. We can use it to wrestle up. We can use it to create different quote unquote sweeps. But I don't think that it's a position that you can say like, is equivalent to bottom side control, right? So bottom side control has very, very small amount of offense from there, right? You know, bottom mount has even less offense from that position, right? But when I look at Turtle itself, I think that there is, when you've gone with good Turtle players, they have not only like skill wise can they get you, but they have so much variety of things that they can still do. It's just like they are playing this risk to reward. You know, they're giving you a closer opportunity to get the hooks in and get a choke. And so, you know, I would probably need to define it differently verbiage wise, but I just more mean in a sense of, I don't think it is a negative position. You know, and it should be, you know, I don't think it should be counted as such.
So that's, I agree, but then I think about this situation. I think about being behind someone, they're turtling, and then let's say I don't have hooks even. Let's say I have a seat belt on them, and I'm like chest to back, looking for my hooks, looking to roll them through, and then they four point, and I start shaking off the top, and I fall off, and they're on top. Should that be a sweep?
Man, I think you went,
because I don't think it should be a sweep.
You don't think so?
No, I don't, because I feel like there's an intention to go, well, it's fucking hard, because even if they do the Mackie Comey roll, there's still an intention for you to take their back, mm-hmm. right? But is it an intention when you have a seatbelt and then they start just shaking you off and you fall off and you're on the bottom? Like, that's a great way if you want to end up on the bottom in ADCC or IBJJF. If you're up and you want to play guard, if you can get behind them and go for a back take and then fall to the bottom position, great. You're now on the bottom position and you got what you wanted, right? So how would you know, I can see being behind someone and they trap your wrist and roll you through. I could see that being a sweep. It was done with intent or whatever, but let's say somebody goes behind you and they get a seatbelt, and as they stand up, you fall off. Is that a sweep?
That I get what you're saying. I do. Yeah,
it'd be interesting if it was, because then it's like there's actually a consequence to a failed back take, which is something that ADCC and IBJJF doesn't have, right? Mm-hmm. Like if you fail and you end up on the bottom. So it'd be interesting if they were like, yeah, that is a sweep now. So,
and I think that this comes of like, so the reason I look at it as a sweep is my opinion on how I teach jiu-jitsu and I teach grappling. And that is that top is a more valuable position, right? And so that is something that I am, you know, very big on. But that is, you know, I definitely see what you mean about like, then it might deter people from going for the back, right? And so if you're trying to push, you're trying to encourage movement, you're trying to encourage offense, it might make people just sit on the hips and just be like, well, yeah, I might lose the back, I might lose my point. So I do I get what you mean on that. I'm leaning back towards the Josh McKinney Invitational rule set, man. Like, the more we talk about it, and you know, maybe point elimination is the move, and maybe it's time for that inside heel hook game of cat
just
and mouse
shootout.
Just the shootout, man.
I was thinking like one way that they could settle that would be turtle. If you have a hook in, one hook in, and then you end up on the bottom, it's not a sweep.
That makes
but
sense.
But if there's no hooks, so if they just trap and roll, or if you go seatbelt with no hooks and then you end up on bottom, that's a sweep. So if you're half on the back, you know what I mean? Then it's considered a back take situation. Mm-hmm. And now it can't be considered a sweep. I don't know. Man.
I like it. I tend to think
that go behinds should even be like, I think go behinds could, you could make an argument that those could be scored. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. If you can get behind your partner, give you like 1 point or something like that.
In some rule sets, they are too. I don't know what I've even competed in that's been a rule. But I know I've done things that if you shoot and the guy goes behind you, he would get two for a takedown.
Wow.
And it was like, even though he didn't initiate the takedown, but yeah, who knows? So just kind of, you know, as we get to the end of the interview, I always have a question I like to finish with. And so, you know, I'm sure I will have to have you on again and we can discuss rule sets. I'm sure there are a million things we could still be discussing. Usually I don't feel like at the end of the interview, I'm like, man, I have so many more questions, but this was one of those. And so I'm sure we'll have to have you on again to do that. But until then, I always like to finish with this question. I kind of ask it like this. What is the best or some of the best pieces of jiu-jitsu advice that you have ever gotten, or what just springs to mind when I say that?
That I've received?
Yes, that you've received.
Oh, geez. Huh. That's fucking hard.
Just take the 16 years of doing jiu-jitsu and condense it down into one sentence. You know, what would be the best thing? Or even just like another way of looking at it is that has had the biggest effect on you over your jiu-jitsu journey.
Oh man, that's really tough. I feel like I have a lot of advice that I give my students, but I feel like the instructors that I have had haven't really given me that much advice per se. They've, you know, like Rob's taught me a lot, but he hasn't had these like quotables where it's like, oh, this is like a life lesson that I should take. I mean, honestly, I guess the best advice I've had, it was probably when Rob introduced the idea of alignment to me, base posture structure. That's when I started really looking at the human body as just frames and levers. And I started instead of thinking about jiu-jitsu as a collection of moves, I started thinking about it as, oh, like if I'm always in a strong position, then it's going to be hard for my opponent to attack me. Right. And that's when I started thinking about my posture. That's when I started thinking about my structures, like my limbs. I started thinking about my base, how I was planted on the floor. And I would say in terms of just like pure jiu-jitsu performance, that was one of the main things that just like it was kind of game changing. It made me look at the sport differently, because previous to that, I was kind of learning in moves and I wasn't thinking in terms of just my body's positioning. One of the things he said is he was like, why are the best hockey players and the best soccer players, the best jiu-jitsu fighters, why are they always winning? What is it about them that makes them win? It's not magic. Of course, like technique, mindset, athletic abilities, these things all do come into factor. But one of the main things was just they know when to be in the best position. Like they're always in the best position. You look at the best goal scorers in any sport, they know where to be. And that's actually a really hard skill. You know, aside from like, I always use hockey as the analogy because I'm a Canuck, but like stick handling, skating, things like that. Like those are all individual skills that you need to have to make the game of hockey happen. But one of the hardest skills I find as someone who still plays is being on, in the right position at the right time. If you're, you could be super good skater, super, super good at shooting and passing and all that. But if you don't know where to be, you're totally ineffective. And jiu-jitsu is kind of the same thing. You could be excellent at strangling someone from the back. You could be excellent at finishing leg locks, arm bars. But if you don't know how to get to those positions and you can't prevent your opponent from like getting chest to chest on you, like you'll never get to those positions. So I think just like understanding that the best athletes are always in the best alignment. They're always in the best position for any given task that they're trying to do. That was really, that did kind of open my eyes, you know, and I realized like, oh, there's more to this game than just learning moves. It has to do with the biomechanics of my body and how am I composing my stance that will make me a lot stronger or weaker. And that's why I always tell, I tell my kids, especially when they're like the new little kids and we're doing like wrestling, I say, listen, kids, like, I'm not going to lie, it's hard to shoot in and double leg someone when they're good. But one of the best things you can do as someone who doesn't, if you don't have a lot of takedowns, one of the best things you can do is think about your stance. If you can be in your stance, if you can have a down block, if you can always have your elbows in and hand fight from here, you're going to make it so hard for your opponent to take you down. It's the kids who stand up straight and their hands are by their side, you know, and they look disinterested. That's, those are the kids that get blast doubled over and over and over again. So I'm just like, yeah, like working your stance and working your alignment is that, for me, that was, I would say that that's pretty valuable jiu-jitsu advice.
Man, that's a, I totally agree. I think that that is, you know, you look at the other side of it is not being in the worst position or not being in the inferior position. You know, you see that in, you know, in jiu-jitsu, the difference with jiu-jitsu is there's not five players on each team or 10 players on each team. It's one-on-one and you can either be in the best or the worst position in each match. And yeah, I really do see that, like, you know, in my explanation, when I'm talking about people competing, like the most important thing you can do as a competitor is score first. And that doesn't mean you have to score early. Sometimes it means you just don't get scored on for a while. And you know, I see that so often because most guys will continue to overreach and continue to make more and more mistakes because they're like, well, I need to score. I need to do something. And yeah, I completely see how that advice could be, especially game changing for somebody who has always only learned in moves. That just seems to be, you know, having different ideas and different concepts to help you with that seems to be where the game is going. And so many coaches are getting this big help from it.
And I would say too, like if I was going to give advice to any gym owner out there, it would just echo what we spoke about last time when you were on my show. And that's, you got to keep it fun. You got to keep the training fun. If it's not fun and, you know, and it's a business that you're trying to run, you know, in an ideal world, we have a room full of like really good dudes, like really high level guys. That's always what every coach kind of wants. But at the same time, you have to think about like recreational people too, because they're going to be the majority of your income. It's not going to be the high level competitive athletes, right? So keep it fun. And another thing I would recommend if I was going to give advice to anyone would just be like, invest in your body. Like as you get older, it becomes more about leaving practice uninjured, you know, and sort of staying ahead of injuries so that you can stay on the mats for long periods of time, because everyone takes their health for granted until, you know, one day they blow their knee or they tear their MCL or their meniscus or whatever. And now you're on the shelf and you realize how actually fragile we're built. Right. And so I think taking those small steps to really invest in your body and, you know, stay up with your prehab and have a good diet and good rest, those are, I think, invaluable pieces of advice.
Man, I totally agree with that too. I think that, you know, those are always advice that when you go, yeah, I wish I knew that when I was younger. It's something I knew when I was younger, but just didn't do, you know, just didn't understand it and understand the importance of it. And as I've just gotten a little older, starting to really see how important those things really are. And then, of course, as a school owner, how important just keeping things fun is for the whole team, you know, for the whole environment. Man, Matt, I really appreciate you coming on the show. I really loved our conversation. Anything you want to say to finish? Any last little bits, anything like that?
Dude, it was a blast. I feel like we could chat for hours. I mean, you and me are basically the same person, we've discovered. So
the American and the Canadian awesome. Version.
Yeah, that's right. Guys, I'll just say, thanks for having me on the podcast, Josh. Check out the Essential Jiu-Jitsu Podcast. Check me out on Instagram at the Essential Jiu-Jitsu Podcast. If you're ever in Vancouver, check out On Guard Jiu-Jitsu. You can come by, train with us. And appreciate you having me here, Josh. Thank you so much, buddy.
Man, thank you again.
That is the episode. I told you guys that was a good one. I told you guys that one, it was funny. It was just, I'm really getting more and more away from the Zoom meetings, but there are certain people that I can really only talk to through Zoom. And I just think that there's still worth doing. Some of those conversations I get to have, you know, this is one of those episodes that I feel like I was asking a lot of questions for me, and just it's tough to know when you are a jiu-jitsu school owner and a jiu-jitsu athlete to know what you should be putting your time into, right? You have a finite amount of time, and knowing what you should be devoting your time to and a podcast and all those other things. And it's it is this constant battle of, am I doing enough here? Am I putting in enough here? And getting to talk to Matt about, you know, how he views it and how he thinks about it was just so much fun for me. I actually recorded this a couple weeks before it came out, maybe almost even a month before it came out. And so I've had a lot of time to kind of ponder some of the stuff we've talked about, and I really think that episode is probably worth a second listen. Really appreciate Matt for being on the show. Really learned a lot. I'm sure you guys would learn a lot from his podcast, the Essential Jiu-Jitsu Podcast. But that's pretty much all I have for you today. Hope you guys enjoyed today's episode, letting Matt close us out on the year. We will actually be back with our good friend Mop, Andrew Ebers, who I always forget his real name, but Mop Jitsu, as you guys know him, who's been on the show a couple times. He is the head MMA coach of Wolves Den. He is Sean Woodson's MMA coach. And we got to have this conversation a couple weeks ago just about coaching, about building a team of coaches, and then, of course, about all kinds of other random and crazy stuff like Mop and I always talk about. And you guys are really going to like that episode, and that will kick off the year on January 2nd. I think you guys will enjoy that if you've been enjoying the show. That's pretty much all I have for you guys today. I hope you guys enjoyed today's episode. I hope that you check out those seminars that I've been telling you about all month, about chest over chest, about guard passing, only available at simplifyingjiujitsu.com. And most importantly, I hope that today's episode helps you guys suck just a little bit less at jiu-jitsu. Have a great day, guys.